Duncan.
In 2005, Circle A Radio covered several news stories about individuals engaged in personal and political struggle. A year later, we've reconnected with those guests for updates on their stories, reflections on their past experiences, and hopes and plans for the new year. We'll be hearing excerpts from past interviews and recent updates from New York defense attorney Lynn Stewart, Portland Black Panther Party chapter founder Kent Ford, Pacifica Radio correspondent and How America Lost Iraq author Aaron Glantz, and abortion counseling service member Judith Arcana. We hope that this series of interviews and updates will shed light on the inspired work that continues to be done despite government repression and personal feelings of frustration and despair. We hope that these stories will usher in a year of increased struggle, energy, unity, and action. Stay tuned for Circle A Radio.
Glantz is a reporter for Pacifica Radio and other media outlets. Aaron is a founding producer of Pacifica Radio's national newscast, Free Speech Radio News. In the course of his work, he has reported from a plethora of countries. Aaron Glantz began reporting from Iraq when Saddam Hussein's regime fell. He was in Iraq for a month immediately after the fall, from February to May 2004, and during the elections in January 2005. His book, How America Lost Iraq, was published in June 2005, and he was on a book tour when we last spoke to him about his experiences as a war reporter.
On May 1st, 2003, the day that George Bush landed on the USS Abraham Lincoln off the coast of San Diego and declared mission accomplished, on that day I was in Fallujah, unembedded. And Fallujah was a place to be because on the day that I arrived in Baghdad, the Americans had killed the first civilians of the occupation. There had been a demonstration against the U.S. military taking over a school and turning it into a military base in Fallujah. The people of Fallujah protested this, and the American soldiers in Fallujah fired into the crowd, killing 12 people. Then, when the funerals happened a few days later, there was also a demonstration. The American soldiers again fired into that crowd and killed more innocent civilians. And no American soldiers were hurt in either of these incidents. So when I went to Fallujah on May 1st, 2003, to try to figure out what was going on, I expected there to be a very large demonstration because that was a Friday. And I expected the preachers in Fallujah to tell the people to go out to protest, and there would be a gigantic protest, and there would be a huge confrontation that might end in blood. And so I thought it was important to be there. But instead, you know, after I walked through the vegetable market and the chicken market and the gun market, the preacher in Fallujah, the most pro-Saddam preacher, was telling people not to protest, that Islam is a religion of peace, and he had been negotiating with the Americans, and he told them that. So there was no violence.
Aaron Glantz spoke to us December 30th, 2005, about the current situation in Iraq and about reporting from Vietnam, where he is currently based. We began by asking him about the public response to his book.
The publisher tells me that my book did something very strange in terms of sales. Usually when a book comes out, it sells a lot of copies right away, and you know, bookstores are carrying a lot of them, and they move all of them, and then it stops selling, especially with a book like mine, which is about the war in Iraq. But instead, my book sold like a slow burn. What I attribute that to is the American people are just waking up to the fact that things in Iraq have gone terribly wrong, and they're looking, you know, slowly but surely for explanations of how it could be this way, because the mainstream media doesn't really explain anything. So my book is one way that people can find out, but there's actually a number of documentary films that have come out. There has been some other books, important television documentaries, and all of these together are being sought out by people who are curious about what's actually happening. And it indicates to me, you know, people would ask me very simple questions when I was on my book tour, things that I would think were just, you know, obvious about Iraq, and I attribute that to the fact that the media, you know, most of them are just stuck in their hotels in the green zone, and they don't leave. They attend the Pentagon press conferences, and now the situation is so bad, you know, the security situation, that even, you know, journalists like myself aren't willing to brave the streets for fear that we might be killed or kidnapped, and so there's very little good information about what's going down. It seems like the situation continues to deteriorate on the most basic issues, issues like electricity, clean water, ability to send your children to school due to the security situation, ability to go to work with the security situation, the presence of 135,000 foreign occupation troops in your country who are a magnet for violence. The interviews that I've done by phone since the book came out in May have just kind of indicated continued depression amongst most of the people that I talk to. I've been following the Iraq news, and the thing that is people I think should be watching when they hear about elections, the most important thing to watch, I think, is the relationship between the occupation authority, the Americans, and the Iraqi government that gets elected. How much control does the Iraqi government have over the affairs of the Iraqi state, and how much is controlled from Washington? For example, your listeners may have heard about a conference in Cairo not too long ago where all the major Iraqi factions, the Kurds, the Shiites, the Sunnis, the secular people, the former Baathists, pretty much everyone but the crazy Islamist fringe, everyone else participated, and they all agreed that there should be a timeline on the Americans leaving Iraq. In a exchange, the Sunni community, which had boycotted the elections in January, decided they were going to participate in these elections that have just transpired. Now, with Bush pretty much ignoring this kind of decision, it leaves people in Iraq no choice but to turn to violence. And so you see, for example, in January, in the lead-up to the elections, there was a lot of violence in Iraq, people trying to discredit the elections with violence. But then something funny happened. Rather than Alawi, the former CIA agent that Washington wanted to win, people who actually represented the Iraqi people won the election. And so the amount of violence in Iraq in February of 2005 went way down. But then in March, people had realized that the new government that they elected might represent them, but in fact would have no power. And so as a result of that, you saw an upsurge of violence. Periodically, the Jafari government, the government that was elected last January, has said, we would like a timeline on the Americans leaving. And then George Bush goes on TV and he says, we're going to stay the course for forever and we're not going to give up, never, never. This makes the Iraqi government irrelevant in the eyes of the Iraqi people. The U.S. military initially toppled Saddam Hussein in April of 2003. So now, almost 3 years ago. Most people were really happy because they hated Saddam Hussein. He had killed hundreds of thousands of people and imprisoned, you know, millions of people and fought wars, you know, first the Iran-Iraq war, then the Gulf war, then there was the sanctions period, then this most recent war. People just wanted to see him gone. So they were willing to give America a chance. But then, due to, you know, all the things that we've been talking about, the lack of the giving of actual sovereignty to Iraqi people after the war, the Abu Ghraib prison scandal, the attack on Fallujah, where so many people were killed by the U.S. military that the municipal soccer stadium had to be turned into a graveyard for the dead, all of these people who were affected by these things turned against the Americans. But something else also happened, which is that during this time, Iraqi society is generally falling apart. You can say whatever you want about Saddam Hussein and his Ba'athist regime, but there was a certain amount of functionality to everything, and now all that functionality is gone, and so people are falling back on fundamentalism, people are falling back on tribalism, people are falling back on sectarianism. The unfortunate fact of the matter is that things will continue to get worse until we leave, but then things will get worse probably after we leave, too. It will take the Iraqi people a long time to put their country back together again. But just because things will be bad if we leave doesn't mean that they won't be worse if we stay. I was in Hong Kong to cover the WTO meetings recently, and I had a chance to catch up with some Iraqi trade unionists from Basra, which is the oil city in the south of Iraq. The trade unionists said there has been some change during the life of this new Iraqi government in terms of control, that the Jafari government, for example, got rid of a law that Paul Bremer, the U.S. viceroy in Iraq, had put into effect, saying that trade unions would be illegal in the new Iraq. And the Jafari government that was brought in by the election, by the people, actually threw that out. The Jafari government put a hold on some of the privatization plans that the Americans had gotten started. But at the same time, while I was talking to these Iraqi trade unionists in Hong Kong in the streets of the demonstration, inside of the WTO meeting, there was a delegation of people negotiating to get Iraq into the WTO, and though that delegation of Iraqi businessmen had been appointed directly by the American government, not by the Iraqi government. So I think that this is a very important tension. Well, you know what's interesting being here in Vietnam is that nobody here wants to talk about the Vietnam War. You know, people in America like to talk about the Vietnam War a lot more than people in Vietnam do. They're mostly concerned with the economic situation here. And now, for the first time after, you know, many, many years of poverty following the war in which, you know, 3 million Vietnamese people were killed, now you finally are seeing a lot of motorbikes on the street, even a few cars. There's always electricity. The society is gaining a certain level of functionality. And with that, ironically, you have the other major way that the U.S. government tries to control the world, which is that Vietnam is trying to enter the World Trade Organization so that it can trade with other countries, and the U.S. government is putting tremendous pressure on for them to privatize everything here in this country, sell off the companies that are owned by the government. These enterprises, people who work there don't get paid a lot, but they get housing and they get health care and, you know, kind of basic services. And the U.S. is basically saying to Vietnam, you can't join the WTO until you get rid of your social safety net and you open up the country to unrestricted foreign investment. Most of the news is here in Vietnam today in this difficult negotiation that the Vietnamese government is making with Washington. You can't very well tell what's going on in those negotiations because the Vietnamese government is not an open society and the U.S. government is not really talking. But, you know, Vietnam is much better off in making these kinds of negotiations than other countries because it has this history of a very well-developed state. It has a lot of good negotiators as compared to, for example, Cambodia, which was joined the WTO a few years ago and was just kind of railroaded by Washington. The fact that Vietnam is not yet in the WTO indicates that its negotiators are holding out very strong. If this is a New Year's show, I would hope that in 2006, we see a reduction in the amount of U.S. military in Iraq. if I were George Bush, I think there will be something very easy for me to do. I could go on television, and I could declare victory. If you look at his speech that he gave, not to the American people, but to the Iraqi people, the day Saddam Hussein was toppled, it was broadcast via satellite into every Iraqi home, he said, "We came to your country for three reasons. We want to get rid of the tyranny of Saddam Hussein, we want to rid the region of weapons of mass destruction, and we want to help you build a democracy. And then," and he said this, "we will leave. And we do not have long-term designs on your country." And he said all of these things in April of 2003, and you know, it can be worth reminding him that he said these things.
On November 24th, 2003, Patrice Lumumba Ford was sentenced to 18 years in federal prison as a member of the Portland Seven. He had pled guilty in a plea bargain on October 16th, 2003, to a charge of seditious conspiracy. Patrice Lumumba Ford is the son of Kent Ford, founder of the Portland chapter of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. He founded the party in the summer of 1969. At the time, the FBI was at war with the Black Panther Party and was engaged in COINTELPRO, its counterintelligence program. Under COINTELPRO, the FBI used wiretaps and informers and plants to gather information about the Black Panther Party, as well as extra legal means of intimidation, including death threats sent to Panther members carrying the forged signatures of other Panthers. Party members were framed for crimes they hadn't committed, and several leaders were assassinated. We spoke to Kent Ford in March of 2005 about his own personal history as a Black Panther and about his son's prosecution as a member of the Portland Seven.
Happened to be one day I was down on clinics, you know, and I think I was selling Panther papers that day, and my neighbor came and told me, he said, Ken, a bunch of white guys just went into your house. Well, years later, I found out it was the FBI. At the time, all my friends that was in the White Panther parties, and all my friends that had went to Canada and they had the war movements, were still protesting the war and stuff like that, you know. They were picking them up on anything, you know, conspiracy. But same thing, they got my son in jail on now, you know. Let me put it this way, nothing was too low for him to pull, you know, in order to incarcerate you, have you end up in, you know, at the city morgue, you know. Nothing was too low for him to pull.
We spoke to Kent Ford again December 29th, 2005, to get an update about the case of Patrice Lumumba Ford, as well as hear his opinions and stories of the recent government spying scandals and other COINTELPRO-like behavior of our current government. In this interview, Kent Ford refers to Judge Jones. Judge Robert E. Jones presided over the Portland 7 case. Judge Jones was also a circuit judge for the state of Oregon in 1971 and heard a case where Kent Ford was the defendant.
Patrice Lumumba Ford was sentenced to 18 years, and now he's in Victorville, California. And I want to thank everyone out there for your prayers and your support and your phone calls to the judge and to the Bureau of Prisons and the Justice Department. I appreciate everything everyone has done. I'm just going to thank you. All I can say is, you know, it's your worst nightmare, you know. Less than a month after he was sentenced to this large amount of time, I mean, for nothing, and not because he's my son, but I mean, you have to see what he did. He took a trip to China with his own passport. He wasn't trying to hide anything. He came back. And that was it. They went to the Pakistani embassy, and the next thing you know, they're saying that they were going over there to help the Taliban. People that's going to do this here, they don't leave on their own passport, and they don't go to the embassies and stuff like that. They go by unofficial means. I said, this doesn't make sense. They set up this informant and his wife, and my son, and you know, being trying to be good Muslims and everything like that, they would go to the house, from what I heard. And I asked my son, I said, are you sure his wife wasn't an FBI agent? She was an operative, but she wasn't an agent, and she really was his wife. They went in on the disguise of Islam, of being Muslims. When this happened, I said, are you sure that he wasn't an agent? He went by to Mars, and Jones even said himself, you can't go into the place of worship with microphones and wire and stuff like that and take what the imam is saying. You don't go in a synagogue. You don't go in a Baptist church or Catholic church and do the same thing. This is not me talking. This is what the jury said. The state law says that. That's what Jones said. And then the little U.S. attorney, Garden, said, the same one who picked up Brandon Mayfield, and I had a friend that's a lawyer, and he said, nah, I can't, but that must be something there. I said, ain't nothing there. They're just trying to get people's mind off this Iraqi war. What better fit it in to have somebody in Portland, Oregon, again, where it turns out he had nothing to do with it. They held him in jail for 2 weeks, and then Judge Atkins, she threw the government's case out, and now they're appealing it to the Ninth Circuit in San Francisco. That's where that's at. Thirty-five years ago, they went in my house, and Lumumba was just probably less than a foot long. And my neighbor came down and told me, he said, a bunch of guys went in your house. And then I called up the landlord, and he says, yeah, the FBI came here and visited me a week ago. And I said, well, did you give them a key? He said, yeah, I gave them a key. I said, what'd you do that for? And boy, I tell you, they wreak havoc in the house. And, you know, it's just going to show you that some things change and some things never do. I got a call from a friend, Wallace Muhammad, that's Elijah Muhammad's son, and 2 weeks ago in Philadelphia, he said they came by here and picked me up at 2:00 in the morning. They put me on an airplane, and he said they took me somewhere. I believe it was Florida. That's what he said. And I said, Florida? And he says, yeah, I don't know. From the flight time, I think it was Florida. And he said there are two other Middle Eastern looking guys on there, all chained up and everything. But I said, this sounds just the way it was described. The Guantanamo chaplain who flew from Guantanamo to Florida, and then taken to the maximum security prison where Jose Padilla and Humvee is at. And well, anyway, he said they drilled him for 2 days and took him back. I said, well, did they beat you? How did they treat you? He said, no, they treated me pretty good. And my friend, I've known him from the SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee days, and he was in the Nation of the Day. I'm not talking about the Muslims from the different Arab countries. I'm talking about the Nation of Islam, the homegrown Muslims. And then I says, well, if they did that to you, I said, it means all the gloves is off now. Anything is going on. And I hadn't heard from this friend for 25 years. But he says, Kent, this is the worst I've ever seen it. He said, even during our day, back in the SNCC days and the Black Panther days, he said it wasn't this bad. And I said, you're certainly right. Just in the paper yesterday, they had my son's name in the New York Times. They're looking into electronic wiretaps and surveillance, and did they get permission from the courts to do this kind of stuff? Well, as it turns out, the president been doing this area since 9/11, complicit with some of the members of Congress. All the gloves is off. They've been kidnapping people and taking them all over the world and taking them to Egypt and Syria and all these countries for torture and waterboarding and all this business. And so, you know, if we let this go down with these guys and these people, then this thing, you know, they're going to come and get any of us and treat us the same way. We have to try to put an end to this war and try to ride this administration out. As Crawford's not at the Justice Department anymore. I mean, you know, he's just making a bunch of mistakes with Jose Padilla and a dirty bomb. Well, I just want to tell him, you know, all bombs is dirty, you know, whether radioactive or not radioactive, you know. The bombs that hit our Humvees over there, suicide bombers, all bombs is dirty. If you're fighting American people so much, this is not me talking again. It said that the stock market went down that day. And then they've been holding this guy for 3 years. Well, I found out that they can't prove the dirty bomb thing. Now they're trying to appeal to the Supreme Court to transform him to a regular court. Again, we let them do Jose Padilla this way, Humvee this way, and it's just sit back and do nothing. The next thing you know, they come grab us. This agent called me up about 3 weeks after they had sent my son away. And he wanted to meet me someplace to tell me about the mess my son's in. I imagine that. You talk to him, you know. They already got their mind made up. Anything you say to them just going to get you in deeper into it, you know. So the best, you know, get some protection on yourself, you know. Get an attorney. And don't say anything. Don't volunteer nothing. Don't try to play lawyer and try to outsmart them. Just stick to your principles. It's just that simple. Don't volunteer anything. I just want to say, you know, don't feel, you know, that you're being unpatriotic if you do this. Just putting protection on yourself, and you actually being patriotic by making them do some work. Make them go down to the judge and get a subpoena, and let the judge ask the hard questions why they're coming to get you. We're in the process of trying to get another attorney now to approach the Ninth Circuit in San Francisco. The main thing is we just want to keep praying and keep pointing out the discrepancies and the lies and distortions and falsehoods of the government. True enough, the guys went to China, and they stayed there 3 weeks or a month and come back. They was here for a year, and then they sent the informant around to the Mars again. Just that simple. And I just don't understand the logic behind this Portland 7 case. It was just a political dragnet. They wanted somebody to pay. And who's better to pay? All these guys fit the profile. They were young Muslims, American converts, and born Muslims from areas like Palestine, Egypt, and places like that. And it just took advantage of them. And who's better to pay for something like 9/11 than some blacks or people of color from other nations? I just want to say, you know, my son's in California here now, and you can write him and you can send him books and anything like that from a bookstore. And that's Patrice L. Ford, F-O-R-D, Patrice, P-A-T-R-I-C-E, 96639-011, USP, Victorville, that's V-I-C-T-O-R-V-I-L-L-E, P.O. Box 5500, Antelito, A-D-L-A-N-T-O, California, 92301. I haven't been down there. His son and his mother went down during the month of Ramadan. last month, and they were able to spend some time with him, at least 7 or 10 days with him. He's hanging in there. His attorney also went down to they filed a 2255 in front of Jez Jones. They both said that he seemed to be doing okay and that he was hanging in there. I just want to thank you all for your concerns and your prayers and everything. It hasn't been an easy time. What happened to Lumumba could happen to any of us, you know. I mean, you, me, you, any of us, you know. And I don't want to see anybody in jail for nothing or locked up for nothing. And that's pretty much, you know, all I want to say. And I just want to thank you for this opportunity to let me come back to the station and give you an update on what went on.
If you want the address for Patrice Lumumba Ford, email info@circle8radio.org and we'll be happy to forward it to you. You are listening to Circle A Radio here on KBOO Portland. Tonight, we are doing an update show with people we spoke to in 2005. And again, we hope that this encourages inspiration, reflection, unity, and action.
In February of 2005, New York attorney Lynn Stewart was convicted of the charge of aiding and abetting terrorists. Known for her defense of members of radical organizations, the Black Panther Party, and those openly critical to U.S. policy, Stewart was targeted by then U.S. Attorney John Ashcroft as a co-conspirator in a plot to aid her client Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman in connection with the first World Trade Center bombing. A statement that Stewart made to the press on behalf of her client led to her conviction. Today, she still awaits sentencing and may face a maximum sentence of life in prison.
During the first year of my prosecution at the ABA, not exactly a bulwark of radicalism, one of the persons who actually is now the head of Homeland Security, Michael Chertoff, was speaking, and one of the people in support of me got up and said, "Why are you arresting lawyers, defense lawyers? What is that about?" And he said, "We're not arresting defense lawyers. We only arrested one." Well, you know, if you arrest one and make that one an example to all the rest, you don't really have to go into wholesale arrest, which might make you look bad. Why? Because you effectively controlled the others by arresting the one lawyer. And I'm very clear that I am an example. I am used as an example to other lawyers about don't get into trouble like Lynn Stewart, representing one of these Muslims, these Islamists, these people the government has tagged as non-desirables or enemies of the state. I do think the important thing is that by using me as this very public example, they sort of send a message to the defense bar that A, either will discourage good lawyers from taking on these cases because who needs trouble kind of theory, or B, will encourage those lawyers who will take on an unpopular anti-government client, but will do the case in the way in which the government delineates. Either of these things really spells a death knell to the defense community, because we really, we basically take cases as they knock on our doors. We don't make those kind of judgments, so this is too hot to handle, although we're permitted to make that judgment. And the second one is we certainly are not guided by our adversary as to how to present a case for a client. That was traditionally decided by the lawyer and the client, and it had not a thing to do with whether your adversary liked it, didn't like it, thought it was right, thought it was within the rules, whatever they thought. You did the case the way the client wanted it done. So that, to me, is the biggest inroad and what makes this case not a personal case alone, which of course it is to me, but also a case of an attack on the Bill of Rights itself.
We spoke to Lynn Stewart last year before the guilty verdict had been handed down. Now, almost a year later, we revisited her case. Tonight, she discusses her ordeal as well as her hopes for justice in a political climate which she feels is ready for change.
People say that the a defense case like fine wine improves with age. So the real reason has been that I have new counsel, Liz Fink, of Attica fame. She defended the men at Attica for over 30 years, and I had joined the team, and Susan Jordan, who is from Northern California, also came on. They needed time to be brought up to snuff, and then the government asked for one adjournment, and then there are some health problems and some experts we brought on to comment on things, and they weren't going to be ready, so it's sort of more like loose ends at this point. The date is now March 10th. I'm not certain that's engraved in stone either, but as I say, I can do with having it put off. They can put it off forever, as a matter of fact. This part of me says, let's do it and get it over with, but the other part of me that's the lawyer says, we have to do this when it's right to do it, you know? And I certainly think that the political climate, the changes that have taken place, even since February when the jury rendered its verdict, have really been remarkable. I think everybody has this sense that things are shifting. And that has to help me. I think that in repressive times, the government becomes more repressive. And that is definitely a part of it. The people who were arrested recently, the Friends of the Earth and the animal rescue people, they just got in under the statute of limitations. The cases are very weak indeed, the lawyers who I've talked to about them say. They've gotten some stunning in-your-face verdicts lately. Samuel Arian, a Palestinian, they brought in Jewish people who had lost friends, relatives, family in Hamas bombings to say, see, this is what he's really about, and that jury did not go for it. So where there's repression, there's hopefully more resistance. Let's hope that. I think we're seeing a little bit of that, and I think more and more people obviously are more and more disenchanted with this way of doing business. It just seems that can't pass a day that you're not shaking your head and saying, just when I thought it couldn't get worse, it got worse. The latest round of congressional attempts at passage of laws that would facilitate the rich and harm the poor, it's hard to imagine that this is happening. But I'm sure for other people as well, it's hard for them to imagine too. And so that hopefully builds the resistance.
So when you're referring to the political climate and how it will be beneficial to your case, are you thinking about the counterbalance to this that's shifting?
Yeah, for example, I think that the fact that the government has shown that really it will go to the executive branch will go to any lengths. It will not apologize for anything it does. It will not say we were wrong and we're stopping it right now. This latest revelation that shows that they were spying on American citizens without any warrants, and they basically, Bush said, yes, I was doing that, I was breaking the law, so do something. You know, I mean, he thinks he acts with impunity, and I think that when you lie to someone, I mean, just think about it in a personal sense. If someone lies to you, that can be very off-putting and very reprehensible, and you can be mad at that person. But when someone actually does acts against you, it's a very different thing. And this clearly, the spying on the peace movement, the infiltration today, the Times reported of otherwise political groups, critical mass by the police department who send their own agent provocateurs into their midst. This then raises it to a whole new level. So I think in terms of my case, I think people seeing it as we've always said, it's just an example of government overreaching, of pouring something into the way they view things to their own advantage. And I think the more we see they're tortured, and I use that word advisedly, the tortured way they see things and do things, that only can help, in my case, to convince anyone who has any decision-making power, and we would include the judge in that, to really stop short and say, am I being part of the problem here?
When we did the show last time, we aired the interview that Mumia had done with you from prison, and there's some new stuff going on with his case, too, that looks like he may actually get another trial. Can you comment on that?
Oh, yes. Well, we're very hopeful, but we were hopeful in that knowing way that the movement has come to accept. Well, it looks good and it sounds good, but until it's on paper, let's not trust it too much. Certainly the court, by saying that they would talk about the Batson issue, that's a jury that is selected to keep blacks or any minority, women, any minority, off of it. That issue is a major issue. When we still had a Supreme Court, before we had a look-alike clone court, they ruled that the prosecution cannot pick a jury from which it has systematically excluded blacks. We are allowed, under the way we pick juries, to just put people off the jury and not offer any reason. But the court had ruled that this is not cognizable when the only reason that someone apparently is being knocked off is because of race. And then they went on to say there were other suspect categories, one of them being, you know, what sex a person is, the age a person is. And eventually, of course, it also came back to you can't knock off all the white people either. It's supposed to be an open kind of an embracive selection for a jury. So in Mumia's case, they knocked off all the blacks but two, and it was later discovered that the district attorney's office systematically taught their assistant district attorneys in Philadelphia how to do this, how to get around this, and how to do it so that they would be working basically to juries who would have no sympathy, would have no framework similar to that of the defendant. So that's why that is such an important issue, and it's really, when I say this, it's black letter law. It's the kind of thing that is not susceptible to a lot of interpretation. It is what it is, and it absolutely taints a trial. So for that reason, it's a very important aspect that they seized upon, and it was one that had been advanced many, many times by Lenny Wineglass, by the new lawyer in San Francisco. So I think it is a big step forward. And the other issues as well are all things that in an ordinary course of business would give someone a new trial. But we all know Mumia is not the ordinary course of business. He is the brightest and the best, and they have a formidable foe in the police of Pennsylvania who are really geared up for this. So whatever might be logical and right may not happen, but I'm determined to be optimistic in my outlook for 2006, and I think that it does augur well that the Court of Appeals is going to review these important questions and not just, as they have tried to do so many times, sweep them under the rug. I'm very hopeful about that, but, you know, when I heard the speech that Mumia had prepared for the Million More March, I was so taken by it, and it hasn't been widely publicized. It is just a model of clarity. It is the way he sees things is crystal clear. He is really a remarkable person. We have gotten almost 1,000 letters written on my behalf to the judge. A lot of them are truly heartfelt. Well, they're all, I would say, heartfelt, but some of them, you know, in describing my work over the years, my lawyers tell me are really some of the finest letters they've ever seen in 30 and 40 years of practice. So I have to send a shout out to all the people who wrote letters on my behalf. And I have to say, you know, we're going to fight this on. We're still fighting to get a non-custodial sentence, and hopefully that is what will happen. If it doesn't happen, though, I also, and this is a promise I make for the new year, that this struggle doesn't end. It's not something you say, well, I'll do that this week, and then next week I'm going to take up knitting. You know, you sign on for this human rights stuff. You're hooked for life. And I certainly am, and I certainly intend to keep on fighting.
Local writer and activist Judith Arcana was a member of the Abortion Counseling Service, better known as JANE, an underground feminist clinic in Chicago that helped more than 11,000 women and girls get safe abortions before the Roe v. Wade decision of 1973.
I remember making a joke in 1969, so this women's movement, like, where is it? Where do you go to sign up? You know, I really didn't have... I didn't have the connection. I didn't have the resources. I wasn't a political animal in front, okay? In the summer of 70, I thought I was pregnant, and it would have been a very bad thing to have a child under the circumstances. And I contacted someone that I thought would be able to tell me where to go, and sure enough, he did. He was a medical student. I thought maybe he could do it, or that other medical students knew how to do it, or that they knew the doctors who did it. And of course, he said to me, everybody here at the medical school says, call this number and ask for JANE. That was what they were telling everybody at the University of Illinois Medical School in 1970. How's that for a different climate, okay? So I did call that number and ask for JANE. I had this really long, excellent conversation with JANE, who later turned out to have a different name, of course. And I just thought it was so amazing. I was so taken with it. It was like falling in love. Everything she said was so interesting to me. And I had no medical interest. I had no political experience. I mean, I was a decent person, and I was no fool, and I was not a child, but it was a beginning. Well, anyways, it happens I wasn't pregnant. It was just the very longest wait on the planet, and then the period. But when I called her up to say, I'm lucky, turns out I don't need it, she said, well, you know, we're taking in new counselors in the fall, and if you're interested, I'll give you the information. I said, well, you know, I am. And so I joined up. And from that moment, everything that I learned about owning power, about being responsible, about believing that individual people have the power of life and death and the power of decent action or indecent action, that we are to educate ourselves. Certainly the issue of women's health. I learned and learned and learned, and I wanted it voraciously. It was so exciting to me. And in that sense, it was radicalizing in the, you know, in the definition of the word radical. It went to the root in me. My curiosity, my intellectual sensibilities, as well as my heart and my spirit. Everything was stimulated by this work. It was righteous work in the world, and it was about women, the lives of women, I now say, from the uterus out. I know biology is not destiny, but biology cannot be discounted. Sometimes when women say biology is not destiny, they forget that we are indeed biological at the same time that we are political, intellectual, and spiritual. We can't afford to forget the body. We cannot afford that. Anyway, I was thrilled by being in the service. I was educated by being in the service. My consciousness rose like, you know, like the sun in the morning. That's how my consciousness rose. And it was indeed radicalizing, and it has remained the heart and center of my sensibilities as a woman. For me, it was just such good luck.
We met with Judith again and spoke with her about her experience with Jane, as well as her views on reproductive rights within the context of the current political climate.
Around the time I was on your show before, I was just retiring from my longtime teaching job. So I am at present unemployed in the sense that I no longer receive a paycheck and I'm no longer responsible to an institution, which is exhilarating and also frightening, but all to the good, all to the good. I have begun stepping up the kind of work that we talked about last time, doing readings and conversations about the history of the women's reproductive health movement in the United States, with some focus on abortion, because that's the area that I know the most about. And perhaps most importantly for our purposes, my new book is out, came out in September of 2005, the collection of poems and monologues. The book is a big satisfaction to me in terms of the work of the publisher and the designer and the artist, who's a Portland artist, Abigail Marble, who did the cover art. And the insides, which I am responsible for, turn out to be looking and sounding and thinking just the way I wanted it to. Making art out of politics and making art out of history carries a lot of problems and responsibilities. I know what I want to make, which is sets of words that are aesthetically satisfying at the same time that they have meaning that's of value politically and culturally in the present. That's a serious challenge. I don't want to be dogmatic. I don't want to be didactic. I don't want to be boring. Memory is like fiction. Some of it springs from what really happened, if we can ever know what's really happening, even in the moment. And some of it is made up. And we don't always know what those percentages are. So when I think I'm, quote, remembering something, end quote, and then I talk to another Jane and find that she remembers it differently, we look at each other and think, ah, so look at that. Think about that. So that's one really important thing. And when I talk, especially to people much younger than I am, I think it's my responsibility to point that out. You know, this is what I think happened. This is what I believe I'm remembering. The audience response is startling in its depth. I always believed that the work was important and that it would be useful. But, you know, until you're with the audience, you don't really know if your estimate is correct, if your work's going to go where you want it to go and have legs, you know. But when I do this work with an audience, either in one of these living room readings like the benefit performance that I actually did in Susan Gidding Green's living room to raise money for our local abortion fund in the Portland and area region of Oregon, or when I'm reading to, you know, 70, 80 people crammed into a bookstore, as I did at Broadway Books and In Other Words, and now more recently in a bookstore in Chicago as well, I find that people are hungry for this. People are perhaps desperate for this. And I don't mean they're desperate for Judith Arcana's work. I mean we want to talk about this stuff, and we want to talk about it in all of its complexity. We don't want bumper stickers. We don't want slogans. We don't want sound bites. We want to be able to say it's like this, and it's also like this, and at the same time, it's like that. And all of these things are true at once, and some of it is exhilarating, and some of it is heartbreaking, and all of it is true at the same time. And we need so much in this time of repression in the media, in this time of the horrors of the current regime in the federal government in the United States. We need to be able to have spaces where conversations in that complexity take place. And I see that one of the values of my work is that it affords people the opportunity to talk about this stuff, not just to listen to me, but to then talk about it, because there's always, beyond Q&A, serious discussion. And it never ends, you know, never ends. Well, of course, the Supreme Court is a disaster, but it actually has been for quite some time. That is why we have the Bush regime, because the Supreme Court has been a tool of the radical right for a long time. My particular position in relation to the court and women's reproductive health and abortion is this. When people talk about the court, they talk about Roe. And while the Roe decision has been an important focal point, the Roe decision is not what it's about. Even when the Roe decision first came down in January of 73, it was clear almost instantly that it was not going to solve the majority of the problems around abortion and women's reproductive health in the United States, and indeed it has not. Of course, now we've had over 30 years of serious backlash from the anti-abortion movement, and they have made a cultural revolution which they have won. So that even if Roe stands, it won't matter, because right now, as we're talking here at the end of 2005, beginning of 2006, it's already very bad. Abortion is hard for women to get. Women's reproductive health is fraught with landmines all across the country, certainly in more than half of the states. The restrictions that have been set around abortion are huge and many. So that keeping Roe in place while you chip away absolutely everything behind it and underneath it is exactly the useful for them and successful for them method they've been using. Sorry, that's not good news, but that is in fact what I think, and I do believe it's also an accurate representation legally and sort of socioculturally of what the situation is.
What's the good news?
Well, the good news is the stuff that I referred to earlier in answer to Aaron's question, and that is that people want to deal with women's reproductive health and particularly with abortion in way more complicated ways than the regime wants us to or the communications media, except, of course, for KBOO and Circle A Radio, are allowing us to. And so we're doing it in other places and in our own ways. We are having those conversations, and we are germinating the actions that those conversations can fertilize already. We've been doing it for quite a while. And, you know, always lash, backlash, lash, backlash. It's our turn, you know. It's our turn. You push it down, you push it down, you push it down, and then it springs back up. It erupts. These conversations are germinative, and they are making for action. People are already talking about what to do here, what to do there, how to do it, what the organizing that's necessary will be, and where it will be done, and who will be doing it, who is doing it, really, already. That's the good news. The publisher's website is ChicoryBluePress.com, ChicoryBluePress.com. And on that website, you can get information about how to buy my book, which is called What If Your Mother? And is available here in Portland at Broadway Books on Northeast Broadway, at, in other words, on Southeast Hawthorne, and your own independent bookstore, wherever you're listening, can order it too, by going to ChicoryBluePress.com and ordering directly from the publisher. That book is one of the primary sources for people who want to know how the Abortion Counseling Service of the Chicago Women's Liberation Union, which is called Jane nowadays, actually worked. That book by Laura Kaplan, The Story of Jane, is an extremely valuable resource, as is the film, the rights to which are now owned by Nell Lundy, one of the filmmakers, called Jane, An Abortion Story, a one-hour video documentary.
Thank you for listening to Circle A Radio. We can be contacted through our website, www.circlearadio.org. You can also listen to some of our past shows through that website. We'd like to thank Aaron Glantz, Kent Ford, Lynn Stewart, and Judith Arcana. Our next show will be on the air January 18th at 6 p.m. here on KBOO. Thanks for listening.